Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, the media long ago declared the Democratic race for the White House was a two-person contest between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. The campaigns have been squaring off in recent days on some important issues and some decidedly less so. This has led some pundits to lament that race and gender have been introduced into this campaign. We'll hear what Glenn Ford of Black Agenda Report has to say about this. Also on the show, media election coverage can certainly be dispiriting, leaving you to wonder if this is really democracy in action. One of the worst effects of the coverage might be to make you believe nothing is being done or can be done to change the way the process works. We'll talk with someone who doesn't believe that, Rob Ritchie of the group Fair Vote, the Center for Voting and Democracy. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
Once upon a time, Rudy Giuliani was deemed by the corporate media as one of the Republican frontrunners in the presidential race. After remarkably weak performances in the early states, Giuliani and the press corps decided that losing those contests was just part of his winning strategy. According to USA Today, quote, "The former New York City mayor has gambled that he could skip all of the early contests and focus on Florida," close quote. MSNBC host Chris Matthews actually declared that Giuliani hasn't been beaten yet, while U.S. News and World Report columnist Gloria Borger agreed that Giuliani hasn't really competed in the early states. Well, campaign journalists should be aware that this is false. Giuliani campaigned vigorously in New Hampshire, spending millions of dollars on advertisements and making repeated campaign appearances in the state. Back in November, the papers were reporting that Giuliani was pushing strongly in Iowa as well. A more accurate interpretation might be that the media made an early decision to treat Giuliani as a frontrunner. The fact that voters thus far have been much less interested in him is somehow taken not as a sign that the media made a mistake, but rather treated as just part of Giuliani's plan to win the nomination.
The current economic situation is confusing enough without media attempts to help clarify things. NBC Nightly News has started a series they call Hard Times, a Nightly News Survival Guide, which purports to explain to viewers how the economy and financial markets got where they are at this very moment, in a way that will help the public understand how to look out for their interests. The first thing you might want to do is skip this series, though, if the first installment, which aired January 21st, is an example of the type of help you can expect. Here's correspondent Carl Quintanilla explaining the situation faced by a representative family, the Friendlies. Starting with a reference to mortgages, Quintanilla says, quote, "Some Americans couldn't keep up with their payments. Banks, stuck with the bills, stopped lending as much, which means businesses are hiring fewer workers, which means consumers, like the Friendlies, are spending less. Consumer spending drives three-quarters of the economy, and if it dries up, that's trouble," close quote. The head-scratching continues as you read efforts to look at the role of the economic crisis in the election. Here's Newsweek's Howard Fineman in the January 28th issue. Quote, "Who has the right cards to deal with it? Among Republicans, Mitt Romney proves his business savvy every time he dips into the pile of cash he made in the corporate world. He had a golden touch, but less so as governor of Massachusetts, where growth numbers were not impressive. As governor of Arkansas, Mike Huckabee produced good figures in a poor rural state, but his advocacy of a national sales tax is problematic, probably the wrong idea at a time when consumer confidence is so low. John McCain can argue that he opposed some of President Bush's tax cuts, but might not be eager to do so when many think that putting more money in the hands of consumers is the priority," close quote. As near as we can tell, Fineman is saying that Romney might be best at handling a recession because he's rich, that Huckabee's call for an indisputably regressive new tax would somehow be better at a different moment, and that McCain could make use of his opposition to Bush's tax cuts, the same cuts that McCain argues he favored and only voted against because they didn't come with spending reductions, but he might not want to because everyone knows those tax cuts put money in the hands of consumers. All in all, not the sort of economic news readers can really use.
Also in the way of ink that might have been better spent, the post-South Carolina Democratic debate rundown provided by the Washington Post's Dan Balls on January 22nd offered readers this insight, quote, Democratic strategists differed on whether Clinton or Obama emerged as the winner of the two-hour session. Some said Obama came off at points as defensive and working too hard to explain his record and his positions. Others said Clinton was so aggressive that it could cost her support. Edwards' backers hope that he will benefit if voters are turned off by his rival's tone and temperament, close quote. So, some thought one person won and others disagreed, while still others hope their preferred candidate does well. Tell us more. The especially sad thing here is that the debate did actually contain substantive discussion about healthcare policy in particular that might have benefited from serious exploration. What readers likely didn't need was another story about whose barbs were more pointed and whose tone was more disgruntled.
In a January 23rd front page report headlined Rise of Chavez Sends Venezuelans to Florida, New York Times reporter Kirk Semple suggests Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez is driving people from the country in large numbers and evokes parallels with earlier refugees from Castro's Cuba. Ironically, Semple's lead example is a family who moved to the U.S. because of the economic havoc caused by a 2002 strike by U.S.-backed opponents of Chavez, a strike Semple credits with, quote, paralyzing the country's oil industry and devastating the economy, close quote. But the fact that they apparently left because of actions carried out by the Chavez opposition doesn't stop Semple from writing that that family is, quote, part of a wave of Venezuelans, mostly from the middle and upper classes, who have fled to the United States as Mr. Chavez has tightened his grip on the country's political institutions, imposing his socialist vision and threatening to assert greater state control over many parts of the economy, close quote. Well, if that's not confusing enough, a chart in the Times shows that among the most rapidly growing Latin American communities in Florida, Venezuelans fall well behind Uruguayans and Guatemalans, and only slightly ahead of Argentinians and Hondurans. In the end, then, Semple spends many paragraphs trying to conjure up a mass exodus from Venezuela, comparable to what happened in Cuba in earlier decades. Too bad the facts seem to get in the way.
And finally, it's one thing to appreciate nuance, but some things should be easy enough to make judgments about. So it was surprising to see USA Today twice identify a white supremacist group that organized a small anti-civil rights rally on Martin Luther King Day as only a white pro-majority group. As one might hope, other news organizations accurately identified the nationalist movement as a white supremacist group. The Associated Press even managed to get it in a headline, White Supremacist Protest in Gina, Louisiana. The nationalist movement had previously been referred to in USA Today as a white supremacist group in the newspaper's January 11th reprint of an AP article. So why did USA Today drop the reference to the fact that the group is racist? A Fair Action Alert is asking USA Today to explain their decision. And in somewhat related news, the trade publication Radio and Records raised a few eyebrows when it announced it would be giving a Lifetime Achievement Award to racist talk show host Bob Grant. In the 1990s, Fair and other activists publicized Grant's racist tirades, for example, calling African Americans savages, praying for Magic Johnson to go into full-blown AIDS, and stating that a black victim killed by a white mob in Howard Beach, Brooklyn, got what was coming to him. That record of, well, achievement was brought to the attention of Radio and Records by a media activist, and the publication quickly nixed their plan. Fellow talk show hosts like Sean Hannity rallied to Grant's defense, which really tells you all you need to know about people like him.
Thank you, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair.
Campaign reporters and pundits long ago decided that only two Democratic candidates for president actually matter, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. Those same reporters seemed more or less content with the campaign themes of change versus experience, though it was hardly clear what either word really meant. But then, to hear the press tell it at least, the candidates veered off course, and certain things, namely race and gender, were injected into the race. Before long, we were debating the Reagan legacy and Martin Luther King's. Joining us to share his thoughts on this is Glenn Ford, executive editor of the Black Agenda Report. Glenn Ford, welcome back to Counterspin.
Oh, thank you for the invitation.
Well, let's look at a lead from the New York Times from January 14th. Here's what they wrote. After staying on the sidelines in the first year of the campaign, race and to a lesser extent gender have burst into the forefront of the Democratic presidential contest, thrusting Senators Barack Obama and Hillary Rodham Clinton into the middle of a sharp-edged social and political debate that transcends their candidacies. Well, before we get too deep into the question of why the press is writing these stories, I'd like to get your reaction to this premise that up until a week or two ago, race was absolutely not a factor in the presidential election.
Well, there are two things at work here, and they're quite related. One is the corporate media's demand that race be an off-limits taboo subject in American political discourse. That's been a demand for a very, very long time. But there's another factor involved here. This is a very strange presidential race, the strangest ever, in that the black candidate is basing his appeal not on not being like other blacks, and that's usually the way it's characterized, but on being on the white man's side. I think like you. He has garnered white support at the expense of black folks. Now, he has done this in so many ways, I've had to pare it down, but here are two. He said in Selma that blacks have already come 90% of the way to equality, with the inference, of course, that if he gets to be president, we will have come all the way. Of course, that's a signal to white people that this is almost over, all this talk about race, all these complaints from the likes of, and they always fill in the blanks, Sharpton and Jesse Jackson. Mm-hmm. But I'm with you. It's almost over. The progress has been almost completed. That is so blatantly an appeal to white folks who want to just not hear about race. If it had come out of a white man's mouth, Barack Obama would have been excoriated by black people. And now, most recently, he, in fact, effectively heaps praise on the Republicans for their ideas in the 90s and on Ronald Reagan. And he talks about all the excesses of the 60s and 70s. I have never heard a more blatant code phrase than that, which, of course, again, if it had come out of a white Democrat's mouth, that candidate would be persona non grata in all progressive quarters of the Democratic Party. So Obama is, in a very real sense, and he's been doing this from the beginning, running a campaign on race, but one that is appealing to white people.
Now, you mentioned Obama's comments to this Nevada newspaper about the Reagan legacy. And the odd part about it, I guess, or maybe it's not so odd, is that the corporate press seems to be coming down on Obama's side, saying, you know, Clinton's been unfair to him because Clinton characterized this as praise for Reagan. And if you look at the words that Obama used, you don't see the word praise in there anywhere. So it must be that Clinton's lying about this.
No, you see every positive word that one could imagine,
sure,
which any reasonable person understands as praise. And you see his reference to the excesses of the 60s and 70s, which he says caused the American public, and he means white people because that's who voted for him, to elect Ronald Reagan. And he does all this in a very positive fashion, as if saying by his judgment this was a good thing, or at least that was the timely thing, given those excesses, for the American people to do. There's no mistaking the effect that he wanted to create as he struggles for conservative Democrats and Republicans. And we're talking white people here.
Now, the Clinton-Obama battle of the last 2 weeks or so seemed to get rolling when Clinton spoke to reporters about Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Act. Her point seemed to be that it takes a president, in that case Lyndon Johnson, to actually sign a bill into law. There were a couple of ways to interpret that comment. The press seemed to prefer the, oh no, now we're talking about race reaction. What did her comment sound like to you?
All this talk about what a biting and rough campaign it is, what is the Shakespearean phrase? Signifying nothing. I thought, and it's seldom that you'll hear me come down on the side of either one of the Clintons, but she made a great deal of sense. We understand the synergy between movement and receptive politicians or politicians who have become receptive because of the movement. And her interpretation of the actual reality of the interplay between LBJ and the movement was pretty accurate. Nothing should have been controversial about that. Obama then jumps in and he takes the cheap shot and says that Dr. King, as if that was the whole movement, was being denigrated in favor of LBJ. I didn't get that from Hillary's statement. But then the press, the corporate media, takes it a step further and says that the ultimate crime has been committed. Race has been injected into the campaign. And that goes back to what I was saying earlier. Regardless of who is running, the corporate media is one of their general themes, and not just of recent years, has been that race, talk of race, is divisive. We should shovel all that under the table, which means getting rid of black people's complaints. In that kind of way, and I think it's quite ironic, Obama's promise to do so and the corporate media's long quest to do so actually fit very well together, which is a reason that Obama is so palatable to the corporate media.
And it's so hard to follow the storyline. We read today in the Washington Post, Dana Milbank is sounding worried about something we haven't heard much about, that Obama, by campaigning in South Carolina churches, might be sounding too black now, which is sort of the flip of what we were hearing, I don't know, for several months now.
SWD, too black, too strong. I have no doubt about his blackness, but his strength.
Well, we were talking about the legacy of King vis-a-vis this comment from Hillary Clinton, and our colleague Norman Solomon wrote a column this week noting that the Washington Post had an editorial headlined, "Martin Luther King Jr., his words are more relevant than ever this election year." Norman noted that the editorial didn't mention the word war. This is fairly consistent with the media's preferred recollection of King. You wrote a piece that sort of touches on the same themes, giving the candidates the MLK test. What did you mean by that?
Well, they're actually, if we're talking about MLK post-1965, the test must center on war, because after the main struggles to get rid of legal Jim Crow were successful, then King saw very clearly that a transformation in society was necessary and that that transformation could not possibly occur. And he said so often and quite clearly. The transformation could not possibly occur while the United States was spending all of this treasure and resources on war. So war of the triple evils, triple threats to humanity, at that juncture in history, was the main threat to the domestic agenda that Martin Luther King was trying to get started and was still trying to jumpstart when he was killed. So you can't talk about King without talking about war. That is a distortion. It is an effective lie to allow King's name to come out of your mouth and not speak of war. And yet, of course, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama want to add many, many, many new troops to the already existing military strength of the United States at a cost of hundreds of billions of dollars, which makes moot any promises they have on health care, education, revitalization of the cities. There won't be any money for that. And that's why they fail the King test, even on that one point. That one point is enough.
We've been speaking with Glenn Ford. He's the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report. You can read them online at blackagendareport.com. Glenn, thanks so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
There are serious complaints to be made about the way corporate media cover presidential elections, the oft-noted focus on the horse race, on candidates' strategies and tactics, at the expense of more substantive questions about what they've done and might do in office, is a real disservice that makes campaign season much less than it might be as a learning opportunity. It's tempting to blame media with their eagerness to name winners and losers before most Americans have voted on anything for what seems to be a more anti-democratic process each time around. But while they have a lot to answer for, in some ways, media coverage merely reflects things that are wrong with that process itself. How is that, and what's being done to change things? Joining us now by phone from Washington, D.C. to tell us about that is Rob Ritchie, Executive Director of FairVote, the Center for Voting and Democracy, and co-author of the book Every Vote Equal. Welcome to Counterspin, Rob Ritchie.
Thanks for having me on the program.
Well, we've just made it through the whole Iowa and New Hampshire phase, where all the journalists' attention is devoted entirely to these two states. We see inside every coffee shop and hair salon in town, with mentions here and there of how odd that is, and also defenses of how, though it seems odd, really what Iowa caucus voters do is somehow a fair indication of something. Why is the primary process so front-loaded in this way, and what do you find problematic about that?
It's a classic example of how we just go with the rules we have, whether they make sense or not, and just keep doing it. And then when we try to correct it just on the edges, in some ways making it worse. Iowa and New Hampshire have this self-proclaimed right to be first. New Hampshire had the first primary, and they realized they got a whole lot out of that, and they kept moving their primary forward any other time a state tried to get ahead of them. And because candidates realized they probably would be first, they were very kind of subservient to their interest in doing that. And then Iowa was able to slip ahead as the first caucus. New Hampshire let them do that. And I'm sure they now regret that, because now Iowa gets, in some ways, more attention than New Hampshire. But they have that same power of just saying, well, if you try to get ahead of us, we will just go earlier. So that the dates of these votes keep getting earlier and earlier. Here we are, you know, just at the start of 2008, and we're heading toward the nomination contest conclusion, you know, still 6 months before the conventions. And it's really just those states kind of keeping ahead of everyone else, and the parties saying they picked a date, turned out to be February 5th, when they said any state could hold a nomination contest without penalty. And almost half the states chose to do so because they didn't want to be left out, because we've seen if you wait too long, you're likely to get left out. So after this sort of scattering of votes we're seeing in January, on February 5th, we'll essentially have a national primary, or at least half the states will plunge into the voting.
Well, a national survey by AP and Yahoo News found 80% of respondents said they would prefer states to take turns holding primaries and caucuses first. It's not like the public is clamoring for this system.
They're not. And there really are good proposals out there that would make it a lot better. And one of the things to keep an eye on, the media hasn't really focused on this story, but the parties have full power to make a much more rational system, and there's a range of ones that we think are much better. We have a website, fixtheprimaries.com, that has a range of the proposals that make it better. And the parties can really determine this. This isn't something that's a matter of federal law or state law. State law and federal law reinforces what the parties decide to do. And we're already seeing some movement within the parties to take action. And I think if we see a train wreck on February 5th, we really can see change, but I'm hoping we can see some good changes regardless.
Well, given all the ink the election gets, it's remarkable how little conversation there is about the process itself. Does it really serve the public? If not, how can it be repaired? When campaigns make charges of voter suppression, for example, we might see some investigation, but very little ongoing and in general about more systemic disenfranchisement. There's an acknowledgement of so-called voter apathy, but it's almost treated as a delusion. You know, some people wrongly believe that their votes don't count. But the fact is, the process does leave people out and does make some people's votes count more than others, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, with just the very fact that Iowa and New Hampshire have this incredible power to limit the field. I mean, candidates start dropping out pretty quickly after the Iowa caucuses in New Hampshire, and then, you know, the next vote or two. And we've already seen the field drop pretty significantly before, you know, 45 states have had any contest, and not even having that contest in the horse race, but having that debate about the future. And you're already seeing a lot of pressure on other candidates to drop out. Like, why is Ron Paul still running? Why is Dennis Kucinich still running? The other thing that I think relates to this is that the media has this great fixation in this sort of simple-minded horse race way on whoever gets the most votes in a state. Like, it's like, oh, you know, Hillary Clinton has won New Hampshire, and Barack Obama has won Iowa, and whatever their margin of victory and however low their percentage of the vote, it doesn't matter. It's like, okay, well, you know, New Hampshire has said they're for Hillary Clinton, you know, even if the vote for her was under 40%. And in fact, you know, maybe the Edwards, Obama, Richardson, other vote, you know, the sort of non-Clinton vote together might have been, you know, was more than 60% and maybe actually would have stayed there if the field had been narrowed to two. And then there's the delegate votes themselves, which is kind of a quirky part of this, that people aren't directly voting for president, but they're voting for delegates. And the media, I think, has a hard time reporting that reality. in explaining what it means and why it means that they really shouldn't be rushing as quickly as they do to kind of make candidates drop out, because most delegates haven't been decided yet. And even those where they have been, the margins, say, between Obama and Clinton right now are very small, and many, many delegates still to be elected, and yet there's sort of lots of pressure to kind of end the contest.
And you make the point that if you're not in a state that's considered a borderline or, you know, highly contested, you might get missed completely.
Absolutely. And so you end up with these, you know, almost all white states, very unrepresentative ones, you know, election after election, having this incredible power to narrow the field. It's nothing to say about the people of Iowa and New Hampshire. I'm sure they care deeply about the process, but so does everyone else. And I think that we can look at ways to change it so more of us have a chance to vote. And then more fundamentally, I think, look at, say, using instant runoff voting in these primaries so we can really determine who is a majority winner in a particular state, along with, you know, making sure that the delegate counts are kind of fairly reflective of the range of candidates that are running. And I think have a schedule that keeps those different voices in there longer so we can have more of a real debate about some of the big policy issues that they're talking about. Of course, what we've been talking about here is the nomination contest, and where most people are going to participate is in the general election in November. And one of the quiet stories that I think is going to become a very big story is that we are likely going through the last election for president in November, where we have this state-by-state electoral college system that, in a sense, duplicates all the problems of the primary process, because some states count a whole lot, Florida and Ohio, and most states don't. And there's a proposal to establish a national popular vote for president through action in the states that has already passed in New Jersey and Maryland. It needs to pass in states representing the majority of the country to become law, but we're seeing it moving in all kinds of states, and if it keeps moving the way it is, I think by 2012, we'll have a national election for president in November where every vote will be equal, and we will have a system where the candidates won't just focus on two or three states, but we will all have a chance to participate equally. And I think that's quite an exciting change.
We've been speaking with Rob Ritchie, Executive Director of Fair Vote, the Center for Voting and Democracy, and co-author of Every Vote Equal. Thanks very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following number, 1-800-847-3993. That's 1-800-847-3993. Be sure and tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.